You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. We've got a great show ahead of us for you. We will be talking to Kevin Howlett, a political analyst from the UK, who many of you will know from earlier shows. In fact, he was on show one of Columbia Calling all those years ago, and now this is show 100, and that's why we've got him back. And it's a good time to talk about politics in Colombia and the sort of socio-political spectrum and background of what's going on here in Colombia. Episode 100 will be focusing on that, and of course, as you know, we will have Kevin Howlett talking to us about this, and perhaps there's no one more informed than this gentleman here in Colombia in the English language to talk about Colombian politics. Check out his website, www.columbia-politics.com, or columbiapolitics.com. That will bring it up as well, I believe. Anyway, very exciting to have him back on. We'll be talking about Bogota, we'll be talking about the peace dialogues, we'll be talking about everything that's of importance that maybe you do not hear in the mainstream or see or read in the mainstream media out there in your countries. We are still pulling in over 7,000 listeners and downloads a week here at Columbia Calling, so I'd like to thank you for that. It's a real honor. I am thrilled. I really am. I am thrilled to say that I've got a podcast, a radio show that pulls in, you know, a niche radio show that pulls in as many as that. So 7,000, please spread the word so we can continue to grow and continue to spread news about Colombia. This is the whole idea of this podcast. As I always say, get in touch if you want someone to be interviewed. That's columbiacalling@gmail.com, columbiacallingradio.com, at Columbia Calling Twitter and Facebook, Columbia Calling. What's been going on in Colombia? Well, the violence of the conflict has, of course, escalated. We are in, I think, what you would call, if you were studying conflict resolutions and George Mitchell's writings, a hurting stalemate. The dialogues are going on in Havana, Cuba, but both sides are damaging one another. We have several soldiers, you know, there were the 11 soldiers in Cauca killed, the Buenos Aires area of Cauca. And of course, in the last few days, in the last week and a half, more or less, there's been more than 40 guerrillas killed. And that has led to the suspension of the FARC's unilateral ceasefire. Really troubling times, tough things, and of course, putting significant pressure on the peace dialogues. What is going to happen? In other news, yes, well, El Nino looks like it's coming back to Colombia. El Nino, you know, the environmental fluctuation in the climate, which will affect Colombia. It always does. There'll be droughts in some parts of Colombia. Indeed, there are droughts in some parts of Colombia, especially up in La Guajira, the desert area in the northeast of Colombia, where children are dying up there, and it's a terrible situation going on. And I think as well we're still having problems with dengue and chikungunya in various parts of the country, especially in the coast and areas up there. But in positive news, it does seem like maps are being created and plans are being drawn up for the demining process across the country in the joint effort between the FARC, guerrillas, and the military. The FARC will be in civilian clothing, and the military, of course, dressed as the military, and they are mapping out the most, wrought areas, the most plagued areas with mines to start demining them. So we are fully backing that. We have to get behind that, and we have to see the positivity of these things. But at times it's very difficult, you know, especially like a week like we've had this previous week, which has been, you know, one of bloodshed and one of lament, really. It's been tough, and we can lose, let's say, we can lose a little bit of our enthusiasm towards these things and lose a little bit of our belief in the outcome, in a positive outcome of the peace dialogues. We have, on other news, those of you who listen to the show will be bored of me promoting it, but if you're here in Colombia on June the 4th, there is an event at the Book Hotel here in Rosales, Quinta Camacho area, well, certainly Chapinero, 4th of June, 7 p.m, Book Hotel, where myself, Victoria Kellaway, and Caroline Doherty de Novo will be leading a chat about our book, Was Gabo an Irishman? So if you're interested in that, head on down. It's a free event. You can get signed copies of the book, glass of wine, enjoy some literary fun. But that's the only reference I'm going to make to this book and this show, because, you know, it's time to move on. It's been a success, and we hope that it continues to be a success. But aside from that, it's now time to move on to different projects. We've got the next project. And of course, my next project, I've finished up the Brat Guide to Colombia, which will be out later in the year, and of course I will be promoting that heavily. My next project is called The Mompos Project, a tale of my folly in Mompos, creating the whole hotel there in the middle of nowhere. So anyway, I hope you're interested in the show coming up. We'll be right back with Kevin Howlett of ColombiaPolitics.com talking about the situation in Colombia. Please don't go away, and thank you for listening. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. We're here in the studio today with, well, he's been on the show. This is his fifth time, so some of you will be aware who this is. It's Kevin Howlett, political analyst from the UK. His website, www.columbiapolitics.com, is about the most viewed website, or the only website in English you're really dealing with Colombian politics. Highly recommended. Anyway, he needs no further introduction, because this is his fifth opportunity to clarify the murky waters of Colombian politics. And of course, we're celebrating today because it's the 100th episode of Colombia Calling, and that's why Kevin, who was number one the first interview we ever held, that's why he's back, but for the fifth time. Anyway, so welcome on the show, Kevin.
Thanks, Richard. Good to be back. As you say, fifth time. Time flies.
Time flies. But you've talked about everything. I mean, with you, we've talked about literature. We've talked about, obviously, politics. We've talked about Venezuela. Just about everything. But today, we're going to focus again on the politics, because every now and then, we need to come back to the crux of things here in Colombia. Last week was a nice piece with Lun Leo, the Bogota foodie, you know, cultural, culinary things. Now we're going to, you know, let's get some warts and all, political comment from you here, Kevin.
So the meat on the chicharrón.
Yes, okay. Okay, very good, very good. So this week passed was the 51st anniversary of the FARC.
Yeah.
That's right?
Yeah, exactly. So 51 years ago, their pointless war against the state, against Colombia, began. They wouldn't see it like that, of course, and they celebrated it. It started 51 years ago because it was the first time that the government went in and attacked what was then a sort of communist peasant commune in a place called Marquetalia. They called it a Republic of Marquetalia. It was effectively a place operated outside of the state's control. They'd sort of decided that it was time to go and attack. Marulanda Tirofijo, or Sureshot, as he became known, was the seen as the sort of founder, if you like, of the FARC. He was there, he was basically leading this commune, and he set the FARC up, in his words, as a kind of defence against the state's forces trying to come in and push them out and break up this communist
but they sent
commune.
And I mean, it was thousands of
yeah,
them,
it was,
and they bombed the area, and I mean, it was 16,000 foot soldiers, I think.
It was, well, it's always difficult with history in Colombia to know exactly who's telling the truth. But yeah, it was a pretty big force, and from the point of view of the FARC, they thought it was entirely unjustified and a shock and awe tactic that's familiar to some of our American listeners, perhaps.
But what interested me about it as well, I mean, this is a communist enclave, so we're looking at 63, was it? 63,
yeah.
Yeah. So, and 65, I guess.
Yeah, and it's for those who know or want to dig out a map of Colombia, Marquetalia was right on the border of where you've got Tolima, Huila, and also Cauca, which is today, in Cauca is, of course, one of the hotspots, really, probably the hotspot of the FARC's activities at the moment. And it, if you know it, it's sort of incredibly verdant, mountainous area all around there. And it's later become a very great, good route for narco trafficking, which it wasn't, of course, then. It was just sort of somewhere for them to hide, effectively. But yeah, if you want to dig out the map and have a look at that, it's southwest of Bogota, Cauca, Huila, and Tolima.
As the crow flies, not far from Bogota, but of course, because of the geography, it's a world away. And I know I read also that they even created their own money in that area to pay off corrupt judges and lawyers in the area. I mean, it's just fascinating.
Well, they're still doing the last bit of that, paying off corrupt lawyers and judges and politicians. I mean, if you look, I mean, around that time, of course, you'd had the... you've got to think about it in the context of the Cold War and the Cuban Revolution and all those sort of things that were coming into play. So if you like the sort of these communes, it's not as if it was specific or particular to Colombia, that idea. But what's happened since, of course, has been.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's now the longest running guerrilla group or rebel group insurgency in Latin America. Well, I don't know if the end is quite in sight or not. We'll come on to that in a minute, I'm sure. But
yeah, it's a tough call to say. I mean, really, if the end's in sight or not, especially in what's been going on in the last couple of weeks. Anyway, the 51st, let's just keep focused on this. The 51st anniversary. I mean, this is a long time, longer than you or I have been alive. I mean, nobody in Colombia really alive today remembers a time without conflict. I mean, it's kind of shocking, really. I mean, if we just bring it back to the basics. You know, everybody knows that there's an issue in Colombia. Everybody knows something's going on. But when you bring it back to just that basic statement that, you know, nobody knows. Nobody remembers a time.
No one does because you've got 51 years of the FARC. Before that, you had a military dictator. Before that, during that as well, part of that, you had what was called the period of La Violencia from the 9th of April 1948 onwards. So... It's almost impossible to find anyone that would have any recollection of a time when Colombia wasn't in conflict. In fact, I don't think there's probably anyone. So it's very difficult. I mean, and that's part of the difficult discussions about peace. It's difficult to understand what peace is if you've never experienced it, and if your parents have never experienced it, and if your abuelitos and abuelitas have never experienced it.
And you know, and the thing is, we're talking about sort of in the 1960s, and you put it in the context of the Cold War, and let's say there is, you know, okay, maybe Russian influence, Cuban influence, whomever, Che Guevara, all the rest
certainly.
Of them. You know, that's part of the time. I mean, we can recognise that that was a global movement. Obviously, it moved slower because of the way the communication was, and then it was a different movement. But you know, when we think about urban and rural Colombia. You know, we say that the government didn't have control of that one particular communist enclave. They still don't have control of this. I mean, Colombia is the perfect place for an insurgency because geographically it makes it so impossible.
Yeah, I mean, there are huge swathes of the country that are... the extent to which the state has control is very limited. I mean, if you think of parts of the Amazonas, for example, it's a huge country, and there are huge... Up in the north, you've got Chocó and the Darien Gap with Panama. Down in the southeast, you've got the Amazonian area, and you've got parts of the Llanos in Meta, where, of course, and La Macarena, where the FARC were big as well. If you think of the sort of crumpled, crinkled geography of this... country that was created after, you know, earthquakes and movements of the tectonic plates, and the fact that it's in the tropics, you get changes in geography quickly. Very snap of a wrist, you get change from something very hot to very cold. You get mountainous, you get rivers, you have great jungle. So it's very easy for them to escape and remain there. And of course, the Colombian state has not exactly been the most efficient and well managed. So you know, there's a lot of factors. In fact, you're just very quickly looking at the La Guajira, which is the driest part of Colombia, right in the north, just by Venezuela. I think it's the northernly tip of South America, and perhaps one of the driest. It's just a sand dunes and deserts, and the state's control there is about almost non-existent. The level of corruption and the people who run it are. It's almost operating a separate republic in some ways. So it's the problem still goes on. Yes, correct.
It's true. I mean, if we think about sort of Bogota, Colombia's Wild East, the Guajira, You know, it's almost, I mean, I say Wild East, it's almost like a Wild West, but it's in the East.
Without the gold.
Without the gold, but with pearls and with
contraband, yeah.
And the Wayuu people, the indigenous native tribe from there, they have both Venezuelan and Colombian citizenship because Hugo Chavez, the former president of Venezuela, granted them all Venezuelan citizenship. So it's this fluid border. They can just come and go as they wish. I mean, that's doesn't go to helping the situation. There is a book, and I've forgotten who's written it, but about who... I think it's a Spanish author who's written all about the contraband up in that area, linking it to everyone. I mean, you know, I can't remember.
Yeah, and there was also the... Leon Valencia book about the Frontera Caliente, so all the sort of hot, if you like, border that between Venezuela and Colombia for a whole host of reasons, trafficking, of course, narco trafficking as well, contraband, and also the guerrillas they operate in a sort of and that's another part of sort of lack of state control or an absence of the state, sometimes on purpose, particularly over the Venezuelan side, so that the guerrillas are able to operate almost with, let's just say it, with impunity on the other side of the border and come over and make their attacks and scurry back into their holes the other side.
I mean, and also, I mean, if we look at Colombia, I mean, we'll finish up this section here, but we look at the Colombian map we've got on the wall. I mean, that huge border with Brazil, how's anyone policing that? The border with Ecuador and everything, that's why Raul Reyes was bombed within Ecuador, the FARC number two back then, when it was President Uribe, and then, you know, these borders are all there, you know, they're completely porous. They don't exist but on a map.
Exactly, and there's lots of studies on frontier lands, and there's a reason why Colombia, many reasons why, but this is one of the reasons why Colombia is a successful place in terms of narco-trafficking. It's easy to get the stuff in and out.
Yeah, this is true. And of course, now we mentioned earlier the area of Cauca, mountainous, difficult. I mean, it's these coveted valleys and sections and cuts where people can bring in arms and ship out drugs and people trafficking too. I mean, people don't talk about that. And of course, the illegal mining, which is immense down there.
Well, illegal mining is now the FARC make a lot of their money. They used to make the money from ransoms or kidnapping, and they still do a bit, but not really. They just kidnap for political reasons rather than for money. Now they carry on with extortion and so on, but the narco trafficking has been one of the main sources, if not the main sources. They're the biggest narco trafficking cocaine cartel in the world, according to some. I'd just like to add that bit. And illegal mining is now, I don't think it's overtaking, but it's up there as a significant resource as well for the FARC and other criminal groups as well. The backroom, the sort of demobilised, what were paramilitary and now reformed criminal groups as well. Cauca's really interesting. I lived in Cauca for a little over a year. And I remember, I think I mentioned it on this programme right at the start, I remember when they killed Alfonso Cano, who was the lead, the sort of top FARC commander at the time. And I remember the hotel I was in just by the airport in Popayan, and you could hear the whir and whiz of the helicopters coming in and out as they went out on sorties. And you could hear them when they brought back the body of Alfonso Cano. So the people in Cauca are really, they really experience the war in Colombia. Now, in Bogota, people don't quite feel that way, but
it's
I
not
can tell
the
you
same.
They do in Cauca.
It's not the same here, you know. We wander down the street, for example, and there are some armed guards here and there, but it's not the same way. You're sitting, like, I've been down to Popayan, sitting on my friend's porch and watching, you know, the Black Hawks flying out and so on. It's a different reality.
It is.
Very far from the capital, very far from the seat of power, very far from influence, in truth. I mean, that's the reality, and that's part of the problem in Colombia. I mean, we're doing a nice sort of, let's say, background summary here before we're launching into the next section and talking a bit more about the politics. But, you know, it's important to talk about these things every now and then. It's important to remind the listeners out there of the situation that we have within these frontiers. And, you know, I've ordinarily been, pretty upbeat and positive about the peace dialogues, which we will discuss in the next section of the show. But of late, I have to say, in the last couple of weeks, my hope has been diminishing. And I've been, you know, I've been writing a lot of pieces for the mainstream press, and it's just one thing after another, bombings, killings, and the tension between the two sides. I don't know how they can sit there at the negotiating table and, you know, address things like, you know, I know that they've dealt with agrarian reform and political participation, but these are still topics that they must readdress under each different, you know, working table, let's say, that there in Havana, Cuba. So it's a tough one, and I'm just feeling maybe it's the lethargy of also having short nights with one month old son, but also I'm just feeling a fatigue towards it all. I don't know. What do you feel? We've got a minute 20 seconds left. How do you feel towards it?
Well, it started off. The point was that it was going to be negotiated in war. There wasn't going to be a ceasefire, and that's continued. It's gone on for 3 years. CAG-1 went on for 3 years. That was the last peace process with Pastrana. The previous one also went on for 3 years, and nothing happened. I think everyone's really sceptical. They've been on justice for a year. I don't know. It's very difficult to remain optimistic, but I've always supported the peace process.
Yeah.
And until they end, you've got to hope that they will come up with something good. Who knows?
Yeah, we have to back it. I mean, surely.
Yeah, of course.
Surely we can't say, no, we can't. I mean, surely it has to be something that we support. But, I mean, you know, it's coming under a lot of scrutiny, let's say.
Yeah, and quite rightly. And the issue is, I think, probably Santos's leadership, whether he can actually deliver it. And I don't think, I mean, the army are doing their job. They bombed very recently this week and last week, so they're putting the guerrilla under pressure. It's whether or not Santos can deliver it with his political leadership or not, and I think that's the crucial thing. In any negotiation, you need two sides that can believe that the other side can deliver. Whether or not they think Santos can deliver is up for grabs, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting debate, but we'll continue on this in the next section of the show. This is Columbia Calling, talking to Kevin Howlett, a political analyst from the UK, but resident here in Columbia. We'll take a short break and be right back. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling, talking to Kevin Howlett, political analyst from the UK, expert in Columbia. Check out his website. That's columbiapolitics.com. But we're talking about, we can say we're onto the subject of the peace dialogues that began in Havana, Cuba, November 2012, and have been ongoing. So we're talking about 3 years now. I wanted a side note. I met an ex-general who has been involved in the exploratory talks with the ELN, so the other guerrilla group. Very interesting indeed. And so I sort of basically doorstepped him at a soiree as soon as I found out who he was.
Un cocktail.
And I said, well, what about it? He goes, 17 months, he says, he's been involved. 17 months. And he said, the reason why, you know, he goes, with the FARC, you could get down to the five issues or six issues, etc. You could, but, you know, they're all going to have sub-issues. But, you know, you've got a committee with the ELN. You know, they all have to say. They all have to have a say. And he said, the end point of it all is that they're not ready to come to the table. They do not want to get involved in peace dialogues. This is a military man, but he said, if you're coming into exploratory talks, we can see very clearly whether or not you are interested in actually being at the table. Now, it's through certain obligations that they are at the table, because of course the FARC is saying, you know, join up and stuff. So I kind of liken it to when you go into a car dealership. It's like, if you go into a car dealership without the mind frame that you want to buy a car, you're not going to buy a car. It's that kind of framework. That's how he explained it to me as well, the ELN and the exploratory trust. They're just not interested at the moment. That's why they've got a list of 150 things that are all main topics rather than subtopics and subcategories. They cannot put anything under political participation. They cannot put anything under illicit drugs. They can't. It's vast, their list of requests. But anyway, that's a side note. Very interesting.
It sounds like Monty Python.
Probably.
The people's front of Judea over there, and the other lot spitting over there. It's kind of all these great committees. It's interesting, because the last time... Sorry, Richard, yeah. I know you're about to ask me something, but the last time I was on was just after the election, and I was sceptical then that Santos had announced just before the election that there was going to be talks with the ELN.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, days before, I think it was a week before, surprisingly, to try and get him over the line. And we all said, oh, yeah, come on, pull the other one, son. So there we go. I think we were prove right, perhaps.
Yeah, it's sad to be able to, you know, call upon memories of such things like that, but it's true. It's like, yeah, we've got exploratory talks. They were in exploratory talks, but equally he announced it to push himself across the line, yes, as we know now. But now let's put the context of the FARC's, that's the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, Ejército del Pueblo, of their talks, which began in November 2012 in Havana, Cuba, with the government's negotiating team. Now, they've got several topics agreed to, but with subsections that they call, they say, they've put in the freezer. So they have to, and that's the actual term that they use. They put them in the freezer, and they'll have to come back to them later. So we've dealt with agrarian reform, we've dealt with political participation, and we've dealt with illicit drugs. And they're now on the subject of justice. I think you can take us away here.
Yeah, well, they basically, since the election last year, almost a year now, in June last year, when Santos was re-elected, he sort of said, right, we're going to put on the accelerator, we're going to speed things up. But since then, we've been talking about justice. Things haven't moved on. There's been no agreement on anything that's substantial and no announcement of any agreement on anything that's related to justice. And I think... people were saying that political participation and so on was going to be the most difficult thing, but if you think about it, justice is the most important issue, or the most difficult one, because it means that the FARC have got to decide whether they are going to pay the price for their crimes, whether they're going to atone, whether they are going to go to prison or not. Now, they have committed acts of... war crimes, as defined in the Geneva Convention. So their argument hitherto has been that they are not going to go to jail ni un solo día, not even one day. But that's impossible, really, in international law. It is impossible. You're the expert on transitional justice, so you'll be able to confirm that. But it's literally impossible. Now, they're looking at all sorts of alternatives, whether it's, you know, sending them off somewhere, some other country, remaining in Cuba, house arrest, whatever the alternative. But it really is about how much they are willing to respond to their crimes, how much they're willing to accept their level of responsibility in the war, and therefore pay the price. Now, their argument is, well, we're the victims here. We aren't the ones that are committing these acts. We are self-defence. And we go back to 51 years ago when they started. It all comes from the fact that they see themselves as a legitimate force that is a legitimate rebellion, is what they're calling it, against the oppressive state. So in their worldview, their logic, if you like, there's nothing to atone for, there's nothing to pay for, there are no crimes. So if you start from that basic principle, it's very difficult to move on to say, OK, well, actually, you have, and you're going to have to pay this, this and this. So for over the last year, they've been discussing justice, and as far as we know here, because we aren't at the table, we don't know, there has been no indication of any progress. And it's, I think you mentioned in the last segment, that it's sort of, there's a tension, is really boiling up here. And that's, we've seen that recently in the acts of violence. The FARC had a unilateral ceasefire since the end of last year, since December. They violated that when they killed 11 soldiers in Cauca a few weeks ago. And of course, the government then were encouraged, forced really to respond, and have bombed since a number of campamentos, a number of camps of the FARC, killing, I think, 41 guerrillas in the last couple of weeks, one of whom was an ex-member of the, or someone who had at least visited the talks in Havana, the dialogues in Havana. So it was quite a strong attack against the FARC. And that has led the FARC then to say, well, actually, we are going to stop this ceasefire now. All bets are off, and we're back to where we were, which is instead of a de-escalation of the conflict, perhaps an escalation again.
Which of course is worrying, and of course I know that the guarantor nations of Norway and Cuba and Chile have expressed concern on this and are pushing for a bilateral ceasefire. But, you know, it's a negotiation, and a part of the studies that you do when you're in this sort of, both sides of the table seem need to come to the table as equals. You know, you can't have one weaker than the other. That's the truth of it. They need to see themselves. And also this thought process that for you and I perhaps is difficult to understand, because you have to get your head around it, where the FARC see themselves as the original victims of the conflict. Now, if we give them that, fine, you were, let's say, countryside dwellers, peasants, etc., farmers, poor landholders, subsistence people. Yes, you were. But we all know that the politics and the form of raising money and the form of conducting this conflict has altered. So it's not, they can't say from day one to now that they still are the original victims. I mean, they're generations beyond that now. That's but for me, it's the hardest thing to get my head around, is that this hard-headed, belief by those who are there in Havana, and even this dreadful lady, the Tanya, the Dutch guerrilla. Oh no, we are this, we are that. It's like, but you're not anymore. I mean, if you're involved in illegal mining, and on Thursday last week, they came out with the thing that they've never attacked the civilian population, but they have asked for forgiveness from the massacre in Bohaya. But they said we never attacked the civilian population, but then. You know, let's just take a very obvious thing. Why did you kill La Cacica then? I mean, she was civilian. Why did you kidnap all these people? They were civilians. Why you can't? They come out with these statements that sometimes you just like, where did this come from? This blind alley that you're leading yourself down, because we can combat each one of them. But it's very tough indeed to understand. And you know, the Colombian people. Are in the people, the regular Colombian population who have all suffered at some level or another, will need to see, the FARC ask forgiveness and do spend some time behind bars. But I don't know, and I imagine the person who's dealing with this most is Sergio Jaramillo.
Yeah,
because he's the most studied. I mean, he's like, didn't he study ancient Greek and Latin first, and then?
Well, it will help him understand the ancient ways of thinking.
Yeah, the ancient ways of thinking. But I just think it's a very, very difficult situation. Now, of course, it's going on and on and on, and they keep coming out. The FARC keep coming out with this. We won't spend a day in prison. It's like, well, you will. You will spend the equivalent of something behind bars or in some way. And I know that they were then started to negotiate that the time they've been in Havana will count for sentences. Mm. But, you know, how is that?
Well, we've seen pictures of them
on yachts.
On yachts drinking rum. So I'm not sure that really counts.
Smoking cubanos and everything. So it's a really tough one anyway. So that's where we're at.
In terms of it is worth putting inside some of the context about the statistics. It's hundreds of thousands of people that have been killed during this period of time. There are something like over 6 million people who've been displaced. Mm-hmm. We're talking this is the historical centre of memory, if you like. So it's not me talking. I've said that there's 7 million victims. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty rich for them to say that.
7 million victims. It's just below the population of Bogota.
Yeah, exactly. And Colombia's population is 47 million. So it's a lot of people. And you've got to look at the fact that half of the FARC's forces are kids. They are people that they call it recruitment, but. What it really is kidnapping and forcible recruitment, or kidnapping, where they go into villages and take the kids and train them up for a life as a guerrilla. I mean, what an evil thing to do, frankly. You also got to think of the landmines that they put. They put landmines in and around schools. There were reports of little girls that were killed as they trod on the landmines as they went to school.
It was 10 days ago.
That's the sort of barbarism that we've seen, and so it's totally there are very little point in attacking the FARC's arguments in that sense, because they are based in no sense of logic, and no right sane person would understand that. You can look at the reasons for their existence and begin to identify perhaps something that has some form of logic. Now, I wouldn't agree with it. I don't happen to be a Leninist or a Marxist or operate in the logic of the Cold War, but I know that the people who are and they're entitled perhaps to those opinions. However, when you're talking about justice, you know, you do have to pay, and their argument is that the state has to pay, and I think it is true. It is important that we do make that point as well, and we are clear that there has been, although it is the FARC's war, it's not a one-sided thing, and the state and the army, in some cases, in their collaboration with the paramilitaries, has not exactly been done in a way that that you and I would perhaps like, and there's plenty for the state to atone for and pay for as well.
And this is part of the deal, and that why all this arguing is going on behind closed doors, that the military want to only be judged and brought to justice in military courts and not in civilian courts. And of course, you know, that would mean no open hearings and, you know, slap on the wrist for people involved. But, in order to gain confidence from the other side, there needs to be these public shows to show that the judicial system is even and level for all. I mean,
This was the thing. The ex-president Cesar Gaviria, who was the guy that was in charge when they got rid of Pablo Escobar, said that the transitional justice, so the legal framework that's been established for transitional justice, should apply to all actors in the war. So that includes the state, politicians, the FARC, of course, paramilitaries, everyone.
Mm.
I think it's very difficult to see how you'd apply that, but it's a sort of principle that's gaining a bit of traction. The military, of course, wouldn't want that, and you can see why.
Mm.
But it would be what would be pretty disastrous, and I think would be difficult for anyone to stomach, would be to see that the military was sent to jail for 10 years and the FARC got away without it. I mean, I think that would be that would not be a recipe for successful, long-lasting, stable peace.
Sustainable peace, that's right, it's true. But it's, you know, I mean, we have these situations, but I think we can move on a little bit from the peace dialogues, because it is tough. I mean, there's been so much combat and skirmishes and bombing in the last couple of weeks that it really has, you know...
It's depressing.
Yeah. Poor girl has stepped on a landmine down in, I guess it was Kalka again, wasn't it?
It was.
In Indigenous Reserve down there. It was placed just off the pathway between the school and her home. And she was just... she was looking for a shortcut, stepped on a mine, and her two friends who were with her fortunately survived from their injuries, but the little girl, the seven-year-old girl, was killed. I mean, and of course, this conflict that's going on at the moment has put paid to the beginning of a joint effort between the FARC and the military working together to demine Colombia. Now, this is a process that will take more than 10 years because Colombia's potentially the most landmined country in the world.
It's the second most in the world.
Behind?
Cambodia, I think.
Yeah. Cambodia, who's going to take the mad cows from England and walk them across the land. That's what they asked for.
Yeah, it's one way.
It's a tough one. But, we've got another 10 minutes, and I think we can move on a little bit from the peace dialogues, because we've focused quite a lot on them, but we've got some big political issues coming up, and not helped, let's say, in recent statements by our dear President, President Santos. Now, Kevin, you had something to say about this. This is one thing. You've written an article about it on your website.
So I have. It's called the Time to Get Rid of the Colombian Monarchy. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But Santos came out, I think it was 2 weeks ago, and said that Colombia is now... More than half of Colombians are middle class.
Uh-huh.
Excellent. Now, of course, if you walk through much of Bogota, which is one of the richest cities, you would come to a different conclusion. If you went to anywhere outside of Bogota, you would look at that statement and frankly be... I don't know quite how to respond to it, but the definition, according to Santos, is if a family of four has 1.4 million pesos of income a month. Now, 1.4 million pesos is roughly about, I think it's about $600, depends on the exchange rate, of course, but around $600 a month. Now, a family of four and $600 does not sound to you or me, I think, like someone who's middle class. Meanwhile, the UN has said that half of Colombians are poor or extremely poor. So I think I'm more inclined to trust the UN than I am a report that Santos has got one of the universities to draw up. I think it was Rosario University, I'm not quite sure which. But anyway, the point is that my point was that Santos and his elite, if you like, that run the country and have run the country since almost the dawn of time, or at least the birth of the Republic, are so incredibly out of touch with Colombians that they think that someone on 1.4 million, a family of four, is middle class. Now, they just are not. That is just... It's just a lie.
Mm.
And it's platitudinous, because what it effectively does is it says, well, you're all right chaps, aren't you? We don't have to do anything. You've never had it so good, was the famous British politician, conservative politician. He was sort of right at the time, but Santos cannot say to Colombians, you've never had it so good, because it's just plainly not true. Anyway, so he operates in this bubble, I think, where Strato 500, they call it, bubble, where he only sort of mixes with the same sorts of people who've been from the same sorts of families and been educated in a certain way, which of course is not in Colombia. And he has this worldview which does not link to what most of Colombians think what their reality is, and that's why his popularity is as low as 23%. He is one of the most unpopular presidents that Colombia's ever had, and that's impressive.
Yes.
What I was talking about the monarchy is, and this is not something that I alone think, even Semana magazine, which is pretty strongly almost a mouthpiece of the government at some points, have called a sort of elected monarchy Colombia, because if you look at the people who run Colombia over the decades of the centuries, it's in the hands of the same sorts of families. Now, the presidents have been two Lopezes, and one of the Lopezes went for president last year. This is Clara Lopez. So she had Lopez Pumarejo y Lopez Michelson. Mm-hmm. They're both in her family, and she's leading the polls, I think, at the moment in Bogota to be the mayor. Mm-hmm. You had Lleras, so Lleras Camaro, Lleras Camacho, and of course you've got the vice president, Vargas Lleras, who may well be the next president. You have two Santoses now that have been president, two Pastranas that have been president, and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. Colombia has been this clique of, the FARC call it an oligarchy, and I think perhaps in that way they're at least correct. There is this sort of oligarchical force or families that have run Colombia, and it really doesn't matter whether they're blue or whether they're red. That's whether they're conservative or whether they're liberal. There's been divided by two big parties that have run the country. The academic James Robinson, a Harvard academic, has called this the cartelization, or the basically transforming politics into a cartel, which of course is particularly strong language when you think of Colombia. And there's been these families that have just run through power. I mean, it goes even deeper than that. If you look at the time from Gaviria, Simon Gaviria is the son of Cesar Gaviria. Cesar Gaviria was the president during the time of Pablo Escobar. Simon Gaviria is now a minister. He is joined by the two brothers Galán, who are the offspring of Luis Carlos Galán, who was killed by Escobar. And then you've got Rodrigo Lara, who is the offspring of Rodrigo Lara Bonilla, who was also killed by Escobar. So it's a really sort of wicked web we weave, as Shakespeare said, where you've got all these families together, mixed in different parties, but no one really understands what they're doing. Now, I'm not a pathologically anti-elitist by any means. I'm British, for goodness sake, and I've... I support things like the actual monarchy, but the problem about Colombia is that these political parties and these political leaders have run it for centuries, decades, but they haven't really done a good job of it. So why don't we just get someone else in? Why don't we have someone new in? Why don't we have a new face that could actually make a difference? And I think that was the point of my piece. And I've had lots of Colombians come up to me and say, "We all know that. We just don't really say it that often." And I think a lot of people living here, particularly expats, are not aware of that reality. Perhaps they don't care, perhaps it's not relevant to them, perhaps there's no reason why they should know, frankly. But if you look at the way that Colombia is run, it is not a modern democracy based on parties that have programmes where you can change hands, and the guys will be kicked out of office if you vote for them the next day. They are often voted out and then they stay there. I remember on an earlier programme I talked about how President Santos, the first time he faced an election was to be president. Before that he'd been a minister, an appointed technocratic minister in various governments, of the centre, of the right, and also of the left. So I think Colombia has there's a real threat to democracy, which is effectively that the people have very little say, which leads to the absurd position where you've got a president that says that someone on 1.4 million or a family of four on 1.4 million is middle class, which it clearly isn't.
And this government has been remarkably good at just moving the poverty line back and forth, just to say that they're taking everyone out of extreme poverty. But if you move the line and change the definition, of course
it's pretty easy to do that.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to do that. But you know, we're winding down the show now. It's been an incredibly informative show, and for once, Kevin and myself have kept on topic. We've been quite calm, because those of you who've listened to us before,
we haven't talked about mermelada. We haven't talked about corruption. So that's a good thing.
Please let's leave them out.
Let's leave that.
It becomes tiring. But no, it's been really it's been really informative. I hope that those of you out there have enjoyed this show, because we've tried to put everything into context in recent events the last couple of weeks here in Colombia. Get in touch with Kevin through his website, ColombiaPolitics.com,
if you've
got any questions. And get in touch with us at ColombiaCalling@gmail.com or Facebook, Twitter, etc., etc. If you have any questions, want to recommend people for an interview, or if you want to hear from, for example, Kevin again, I'm sure he will be on the show again, but we like to know which way to steer the show, for our audience out there, and I appreciate that immensely. And let me just take this moment to say thank you, Kevin, for coming on the show for the fifth time, episode 100.
Thanks for having me back, and it's always good to be here.
Yes, episode 100. Who would have thought we'd have come this far? I might just pour myself a whiskey in celebration. Is it too early?
No.
It's 6 o'clock somewhere in the world. But anyway, it's been a fun show to talk, albeit a little bit negative, albeit a little bit, down in the dumps regarding the political situation.
Realistic.
But we're trying to actually tell you what's going on. We're trying to give you an idea that perhaps is not covered in the mainstream press out there. And that's why, I would hope, that's why you're listening to this little niche online podcast, radio show, etc. So anyway, it's been a real pleasure again. Thank you for listening. Do get in touch. We'll be back next week. I know I have a very special guest. I'll give you a hint. He was abandoned at 7 months and then adopted by a US family. He was abandoned here in Bogota at 7 months of age, and we're going to get him on the phone from Iowa, no less, and talk to him about his experiences coming back to Colombia and opening up the file, trying to find his parents and so on and so forth. So very interesting indeed for that one. So stay tuned to Colombia Calling. I hope you keep enjoying the show. Thank you once again. I've been Richard McCall. This has been Colombia Calling, and we're signing off.